mitochondria. Welcome to the summit, Dr. Watts.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
So every interview, he's got to throw some biochemistry in. I know he wants to talk about solutions, but why don't we dive into biochemistry first? Because, of course, that's your passion.
So looking at what the whole summit is the mitochondria. That's what I love to talk about all the time anyways. So the big part is, how does it operate, and then why is it important, and what's affecting it? Because if once we understand the deeper part of why it's not working right, then we can go and find the solutions. So,
which means you want to explain the biochemistry first.
Yes, okay. I want to explain the biochemistry, which is what I love to do. So looking at how to make energy, there's two parts of energy. There's the aerobic respiration, right, that we do, which is within the mitochondria. And then there's the anaerobic respiration. So there's in the cell, outside of the mitochondria, there's a process called glycolysis, where we take a sugar, break it down into a pyruvic acid or pyruvate. That's the end part. And that's the part that comes into the mitochondria. During that process, we make a little bit of energy, a little bit of ATP, right? And as long as everything goes well, then that pyruvate molecule will enter into then the mitochondria. Once it's in the mitochondria, it goes through this process to be converted to acetyl-CoA. And acetyl-CoA is the molecule that will go into what we call Krebs cycle. And the Krebs cycle is where we create molecules like NADH, FADH2. These are things that will help to basically fuel the electron transport chain that will allow us to then attach a phosphate onto an ADP molecule to make ATP. And that's the end thing, right? We want ATP because ATP is going to be the energy molecule that fuels all of these 500 plus enzymatic reactions in our bodies, as well as the signaling molecule that helps our immune system understand there's something we're fighting for.
So backing up just to see if I'm clear on this, pyruvate, is that made outside of the cell?
Yes.
Okay. And then it goes inside the cell to then get converted to acetyl-CoA?
It's made inside the cell in the cytosol and then kind of goes into the mitochondria.
Okay. And then that's where the acetyl-CoA comes in to further. So essentially pyruvate is the initial step of energy or movement for mitochondria to make ATP.
So it is the process of taking a sugar molecule or a protein which gets converted to a glucose molecule and then breaking down into a 3-carbon molecule. And that process will all happen through the glycolysis reaction. And so it's just the end, what we call end metabolite or end product of glycolysis. And then if we have enough oxygen at that point, then it can be converted and go into and be utilized to make ATP or energy with oxygen, called aerobic respiration. And lots of people understand jogging will get that aerobic respiration. But if you do, say, a sprint, you do what we call anaerobic respiration. Mm-hmm. That basically takes pyruvate and converts it to lactic acid, which most of us understand, oh, my muscles are sore. Like our workout a couple of days ago, we're all sore from that workout that we were doing because of the anaerobic respiration. So we weren't jogging, we were lifting and pushing our bodies really hard, fast. You know, our muscles ran out of oxygen and at that point converted to lactic acid. So when I'm working with somebody that's chronic illness or somebody that's, say, with Lyme disease or mold toxicity or chronic fatigue, a number of different things, what I look at is, are they producing energy? Because if it can't produce energy, how are they going to perform all these enzymatic reactions that need to occur? Now, the other thing we look at is fat. How do we get energy from fat? Because the ketogenic diet's really popular out there, or fasting's really popular, and that breaks down fat. So we take fat, and that's when it's broken down, it's converted to a molecule called fatty acid. So 3 fatty acids and a glycerol molecule. Those fatty acids are what are transported into the mitochondria, and then from there are broken down into acetyl-CoA. So it goes through this process called fatty acid oxidation, basically breaking down that fatty acid long chain carbon molecule into these acetyl-CoA molecules that go through Krebs cycle and then the same process as a sugar. It's just that sugar does it from a standpoint of glycolysis.
So you can either use sugar, which could be protein to sugar, or carbohydrate, obviously, is sugar to ATP. You could use fatty acids or fat, basically, to then make ATP. What happens when it's anaerobic and you make lactic acid? Is there ATP production in the lactic acid?
No, lactic acid then is recycled back through the liver and then converted back to pyruvate and goes through its process of breaking down.
Okay.
So it's really comes back to the liver takes care of lactic acid. The thing about it is we don't want to go towards lactic acid because people can get the buildup of lactic acid, and there's conditions called lactic acidosis that other doctors talk a lot about, but it's the process of why do they have it? So is it a lack of oxygen? So it could definitely be a lack of oxygen, especially if they have a lot of mold in them, right? Another thing it could be is toxins. So there's that reaction called the PDH or pyruvate dehydrogenase complex that takes pyruvate, converts it to acetyl-CoA, and stuff like heavy metals can cause a breakdown in that process. So lead, arsenic, mercury, other radioactive elements can all break up that process and not or inhibit those enzymes that are supposed to convert that. So then the pyruvate, what does it do? It has to go back into and convert to lactic acid. Or if there's a lack of oxygen, it can't convert. So it then goes over into lactic acid.
Does that overburden the liver then if you are constantly making a lot of lactic acid?
Absolutely. Because this is occurring in the liver, right? It's typically there's a lot of infection going on in there. And it's, the liver's overwhelmed in this process that's happening. So if the liver's overwhelmed because of all these infections, which infections seem to really have a high affinity for the liver with everything that happens there, then the function of the mitochondria is really brought down. That's what we want to look at is okay, how many mitochondria are in each cell in the liver? You know, how many mitochondria are in each cell of the heart and the brain? Well, we're looking at somewhere between, 2,000 to 10,000 per cell. The mitochondria are really important for utilizing oxygen in the cell. The mitochondria are really important for creating energy. And then not only that, but also cell signaling and immune response.
You hear people talk about how many cells we have in our body and how huge of a number in the trillions it is. But you just said that some individual cells have up to 10,000 mitochondria per cell.
Per cell.
So that means our mitochondria are astronomically way bigger than even our human cell number.
Exactly. Okay. And that's why people talk about bacteria, right, being so much more bacteria and microbiome than our own cells within the body. And part of what contributes towards that is the mitochondria. So with being multiple types of mitochondria per cell, and you know what you see with athletes is they have more mitochondria, right? Because they have better utilization of oxygen. When they're working out, their cells are creating more mitochondria or more mitochondria coming into those cells to help with all that aerobic respiration.
So clinically, with the clients that you guys see in your office, you know, with your doctors and things, what are you seeing as far as like infections and toxins that damage the mitochondria most? I mean, you listed a lot off. Is it kind of that whole gamut or are there specific things? Like even, for instance, the liver. You said infection really tends to like the liver. Are there certain infections that you find clinically?
Yeah, so what's coming into my clinic, at least that I'm seeing, is people that have Lyme disease, the co-infections. Babesia loves the liver. Also, Epstein-Barr and many viruses really love the liver. There's parasites that can affect it. Liver flukes. Strange lories can get up in there. Sometimes roundworms. So it clogs it up and then it backs everything up. And the key part to having a successful liver is to having a non-toxic liver. That means things have to be moving through. And as things aren't moving through and things are backing up, these infections put out byproducts like ammonia, for example. And that suppresses the body's ability to make energy. And it suppresses the function of the mitochondria. So they don't work so well. So if you think about being and you want to have all this energy to work out, but you're in this super hot climate and lots of humidity and you just feel sluggish because of that. Well, the same thing with the mitochondria. If they're in an environment that's not conducive to them, then what happens with that environment is that it's going to be less functional.
Okay. So essentially the cause of what's diminishing mitochondria at the cellular level and with all the biochemistry pathways you went through, chronic infection, toxins, those are main things. And obviously mold lowers oxygen, but mold produces toxins like biotoxins.
Exactly. Okay. So it's really important and it suppresses oxygen utilization. And then you consider some of the radioactive elements where that really breaks down the cell. And when you have all these free radicals going on, oxygen is our final electronic acceptor. So it binds onto those free radicals and then helps to then get converted to water. And glutathione is involved in that process. And there's catalase and a number of other enzymatic reactions within that process. The key part is taking that free radical and then binding that oxygen on there and then clearing it out. So we could be using a lot of oxygen just fighting these radioactive elements, these toxins, these chemicals, whatever you want to call them, these infections, and instead of being able to utilize it to make energy.
Okay.
And that's the thing. It's like, all right, are we utilizing mitochondria to survive and our energy to survive? or are we utilizing it to have optimal energy and feel vital and able to function and do everything we want to do? I know you've worked with a lot of people in Lyme disease world and in my clinic, but we see these people have suppressed energy. Why? Because these infections like Lyme and Epstein-Barr, they suppress the energy levels down so that they can thrive.
Is there a way to measure clinically oxygen in the body for a client?
I think that there's some ways, but there's that we can look at it. One, you look at saturation, being sure they're able to get the exchange through their lungs.
Okay.
Two, there's a perfusion index that you can look at. I'm still diving into the research and how accurate that is and moving that forward. That's helped me at least get some gauging of where somebody may be and then later on see how much better it is. Yeah, there's some other things we're looking into of how can we measure this to be a higher level than just oxygen saturation.
Yeah, because you'll see, I mean, oxygen saturation typically is pretty high for most individuals.
Yes.
But the perfusion index seems like that's not quite like, oh, everybody's got great levels of that when they have chronic health issues. It seems like that level could be actually really low.
It could. And what I think that is how well is the blood getting throughout the body.
Okay.
Okay. So if the blood's not getting throughout the body very well, or if somebody has edema and they're swollen and things, they're not going to have great perfusion. So with that process, their blood pressure is going to go up higher to try and push that perfusion out, right? And that's maybe another way to look at that. So that's where when I'm analyzing blood pressure, a lot of people maybe that have Lyme or Babesia or some of these other viruses and infections tend to have low blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So then they're not getting enough blood throughout the body.
Mm.
Or other people that their heart's working good, blood pressure is really high because they have a high need for oxygen, so their body's trying to push out the blood through the body. So looking at both high or low is a way to really consider what's going on with these people. I had low blood pressure for a long time, and mine's come up and it's doing a lot better. Of course, I have a lot better energy now too with that because oxygen's getting through the body and nutrients are getting through the body.
Well, and you've had a history of maybe not having the best energy in your past.
Yes, severe fatigue, for sure.
I mean, what happened in chiropractic school when you were going through school?
There was a Facebook page that was created called Sleeping in School. And it started with some of the guys in my class taking pictures of me not being able to stay awake. Even at 7:30 in the morning, I was so affected by certain things. One, gluten, which would shut my brain off, and I just would fall asleep almost within 30 minutes of eating that.
Wow.
The fatigue I had with muscular fatigue, brain fatigue, and overall general malaise or fatigue.
You've come a long ways.
I have. And that's why mitochondria is so important, right? Because it's such a vital part of this process. And for me, it was a journey. First, what I did was I cleared the parasites that we talked about before that helped my overall general toxicity come down
mm-hmm.
and my overall energy start to come up. But I still couldn't work out as I went further, you know, clearing other infections and toxins. My brain started turning on better and working better. I could function and have good brain capacity till 10 o'clock at night, where before it was still 4 o'clock and I was burned out. And then other times even earlier, you know, it would vary day to day. Also what I was exposed to or ate, you know, up until a year and a half ago, I just couldn't work out well. The energy generated within my muscles and stuff was very low. And as I cleared out more, I think that some of the radioactive elements, radiation and toxins, all of a sudden my mitochondria turned on, energy turned on, and I could work out. And now I feel, you know, phenomenal and much better than I have in 15 years.
Well, I can attest to that because we were up probably till 9:30 or 10 talking last night. You were very with it. And then we were up early this morning working out. So
yeah.
Living the life. Clarify radioactive elements because you've said that a few times. What does that mean when you say radioactive elements?
When I'm looking at things that are really harsh to the body, we've heard about heavy metals quite a bit. We've heard about infections. As I've researched and worked with people, what I've noticed is that there's exposure to radiation. Radiation is the hardest or the worst thing to our cells. The types of radiation that there are, there's non-ionizing and there's ionizing radiation. And the ionizing radiation will actually rip apart our DNA, rip apart our cells, creating lots of oxidative stress. So with that oxidative stress, your cells can't function, you're using up all your oxygen, you're not making energy, it just destroys everything. So that is really, with disease, I think one of the worst things that we're seeing today of, you know, there's Fukushima, there's all the different things that we know of in that manner, and there's exposure with those, but also it's within our soils and our water. So when we look at, there's uranium, there's cesium that we see on heavy metal testing, thorium, and uranium and thorium break down to radium. And radium is about 3,000 times more actually radioactive than uranium is. And then from there, it can gas off into a molecule called radon, which people have in their basements or, you know, in the environment. We just don't realize because it's not measured in a heavy metal test. You know, when we started researching this, there's radium belts like in Wisconsin and in Illinois. And then you see in Texas, there's lots of people exposed to a lot of radium. It's in the municipality water. So there's an environmental working group that did a compilation of numbers from the EPA that showed where you're at and how much radium was in the water sources there. And so it does naturally occur within the Earth's crust. Then it's hopefully getting pulled out. And that's where it's important to look at the water you're drinking, because that could be a major exposure of radiation.
And once you have these radioactive elements inside, the half-life could be hundreds, thousands of years. So, I mean, essentially they can just continually be emitting damage to your DNA until you pull them out.
Exactly. And what we've seen with radium is that it's a bone seeker. So it's like lead. It goes into the bones. And then what's in the bones? Well, we got our bone marrow, our immune system. So it can highly affect and suppress immune function and or distort that process. What I started seeing is as we worked with people, all of a sudden their white blood cell counts that were low for years and years and years started coming up again.
Mm. Yeah, and just thinking about the environmental working group, I mean, 170 million Americans have radium in the water. And you said Texas, 80% of Texas. And that's a huge state.
It's a huge state. It's a huge amount of population.
It's just crazy. And then thinking about the rise of osteoporosis, and you said radium loves bone, loves to compete for calcium, kind of like lead, you know, heavy metal.
It does.
So at what point do you think radium is actually more impactful to osteoporosis than lead? Or do you think it's a combination?
It could be a combination, but I think that radium is more impactful because radium would affect the cells that are trying to rebuild the bone, more so, in my opinion, than lead. Where lead deposits, but radium with the radioactivity, it's like, okay, why aren't they rebuilding the bone? It's the osteoblasts. So why aren't the osteoblasts working? Maybe it's the radiation.
Wow.
It's theory. It's what we're working through and learning about. But it makes a lot of sense to me now because it's like, why did they just magically have osteoporosis? Why do they have osteoporosis?
Because they're not consuming enough calcium.
Right, exactly. Countries that don't consume the calcium don't have osteoporosis either.
Right.
So it's more something that's displacing the calcium. There again, we do have a lot of lead in our water as well. But what we're not looking at is the radium that's in the water source too. So it could be a combination, but I really think that the radium would have a more of an effect on the cells that build the bone and repair the bone.
Is it wrong to assume then if somebody is struggling with health that probably their oxygen levels in their body aren't optimal and that we just need to focus on improving oxygen?
I think that's really important to look at. So are they very highly energetic or are they lower energetic? What's their blood pressure at? If their blood pressure is low, then probably they're low energetic as well.
Yep.
And then they get people that have like this POTS syndrome where they get lightheaded, they get dizzy really well, they might black out a little bit. And with that, what I found on helping these people is parasites have played a major role in that. Sometimes viruses like Epstein-Barr, and then looking at some of the radioactive elements that are processed there. So there's a variety of radioactive elements. We mentioned the cesium. There's radioactive lead, there's radioactive iodine, there's radioactive the strontium, the radium, the uranium, the thorium. But I think people that have it in them are more sensitive now to other non-ionizing radiation. So the cell phones, you know, all the maybe the 5G that's coming out, all this stuff here, these people are going to be more sensitive and more reactive to it.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, a lot of attention has been given to heavy metals, like you said. But I'm hearing that really more attention needs to be given to the radioactive elements.
Yes, exactly. And I think when we address those issues, you're going to see that the radioactive elements cause more damage to the cells.
Okay.
Right? Because they're destroying the DNA. They're ripping those things apart. Where the other stuff is toxic, but not necessarily as damaging. They create free radicals, but not ripping things apart. They're both important, right?
Yep.
Arsenic's not healthy because it stops the electron transport chain. It stops the ability to make ATP. Glyphosates and pesticides, herbicides also block that process of that free radical coming across or that electron coming across to create ATP. It ends up creating a free radical that starts to break the cell down and the body down and creates oxidative stress, which then can go into all kinds of problems from that point on because now you have low mitochondrial function, which means you're going to have a higher infection issue. And then you're also going to have low energy. And then also then you look at all these cells, all these mitochondria within these organs. Like your brain needs a lot of mitochondria to function. now it's the function of it is lower because the mitochondria are not working at the capacity they need to.
Backtracking to all the biochemistry pathways, and I don't want to cause stress to the listener, but backtracking to that, what are takeaways clinically? Are there certain like supplements that you look at that can help to improve the pathway, or is the main takeaway that toxins and infection can hinder that whole process?
There are a few nutrients that I consider and look at. One is, are we transporting the fatty acids from the fat breakdown into the cells?
Okay.
So if you're struggling with adrenal fatigue or thyroid function and you go to fasting or you go into a ketogenic diet, some of these people swell up, they gain weight, they don't feel well, right? So they're probably struggling to get that fatty acid inside the cell and break it down to create energy. So they may need something like an L-carnitine product because the carnitine amino acid will transport that fatty acid into the mitochondria.
Okay.
From the cytosol of the cell. The other thing we look at is your B vitamins are necessary. So with the conversion of pyruvate and the conversion of acetyl-CoA, and also then taking acetyl-CoA through that Krebs cycle, there's the B vitamins, B1, B2, B3, B6, B5 more so. B6 is more on the fatty acid side. Then you look at alpha-lipoic acid. So there's lots of complexes out there that support it. But to me, what's important in the process is not, you know, we get a lot of those in our diet, right? Mm-hmm. We eat that stuff, or you should be eating nutrients that have that. You should be eating well. It's the process of what's inhibiting that the functionality of those systems. What's causing the problem? So my approach is to this process, let's be sure we're draining the body well so we can get the toxins out of the body. Let's get that toxin load down. Let's then get the right binders in there and the right energy in there to clear it out. So supporting, I use a lot of bioactive carbon molecules to go in and support the processes and to feed the mitochondria the right foods and the nutrients and support the amino acids and the other things it needs to do enzymatic reactions within that. And also at the same time, pulling out those heavy metals, the toxins, the radiation, clearing the infections out of the body. By clearing the infections out of the body, that helps to reduce the toxic load in the body. Right, so it's going to be hard to get mitochondrial function if you have high mold in you, or if you have high amount of parasites or viruses. So it's a balancing act. The first process is drainage and energy. The next process is pulling the stuff out, the toxins and everything out, as then you build up.
So you mentioned radiation, radioactive elements. Is that essentially kind of the same thing?
Same thing. Okay. They're just different types of radiation that we're exposed to. And the ionizing is usually more severe than the non-ionizing.
Yeah. Non-ionizing would be microwaves, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, that thing.
Exactly.
But the ionizing, you're saying, is actually where it breaks DNA bonds, which obviously have a lot more damaging effects.
And it also affects the membranes of the cells too, right? And create a lot of free radicals. So with that, we're looking at X-rays and, you know, those types of imaging. You're looking at the exposure